My whole life has changed now that my apartment is in the flight path for one of those new Amazon octocopter delivery drones. Beat it, drone. I didn't order anything. You've got the wrong window. Again. Anyway, you should... Is that Charlie Rose's head? You're supposed to deliver packages. You're not supposed to decapitate broadcasting icons and then drag them around like a cat with a dead bird. Bad drone.
Hey, that Amazon drone is probably for me. I ordered some Charlie perfume for you and a Pete Rose jersey and a Mr. Potato Head. I hope they all arrived.
You ordered Charlie perfume, Pete Rose, and Mr. Potato Head, and look what the stupid drone brought you.
Charlie Rose's head? Maybe you're being a little hard on that drone. You tried, didn't you, boy? And that was really close. You just ran a few names together. Here, want half a power bar?
Don't share food with it, Greg. That sends the wrong message. You are so terrible at boundaries and setting limits. This is just like when our Roomba pushed the visiting nurse out the window. There were zero consequences that time. None at all. Today on our Monday Scramble, we'll follow up on the Pope's critique of capitalism, analyze the Metro North derailment, and talk to Brian Slattery about how each new generation of musicians discovers Kurt Vile. And now he ordered Attack of the Drones, but do they know that's just the name of a movie? Colin McEnroe.
I hope they know it's just the name of a movie. All right, yeah, this is our kind of a relatively new project of ours, the Monday Scramble. Our whole idea is not to plan too much for Monday, but just to let the weekend speak to us a little bit and to surprise ourselves with what we wind up talking about. So today, probably the lowest level surprise will be that we're talking about Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation. That'll be a little bit later with Michael Shawn Winters. I really do regard this as probably an under-discussed document, although it came up at my Thanksgiving party, but I feel as though Pope Francis has said some pretty revolutionary things here, and I don't know whether they're being discussed more in other countries, but anyway, we'll be talking about that and sort of reactions to that, how to understand this fairly complicated document, but it does have this pretty acute takedown of capitalism in it. And then one of the other things that we had decided that we would do is that we would bring somebody on, some kind of big ideas person, and let him or her tell us what to talk about, although I kind of gamed this one a little bit, but Brian Francis Slattery will be with us later. And one of the things he turned out want to talk about is the influence of Kurt Vile on young musicians today. Now, there's a topic out of left field for you. We'll also talk about the Amazon drones, just because I insist, and also about some controversy about whether or not there should be negative book reviews. BuzzFeed has just instituted a new book editor whose attitude is, if you can't say something nice, as Thumper said, don't say anything at all. But this idea has been echoing around a little bit of late. But we would be remiss if we did not talk about what happened yesterday on the Metro North trains. Most of you probably know there was an early morning derailment. Four people dead. Quite a few more people sent to the hospital, many of them in critical condition. This is a very, very serious accident. And it comes at the end, we hope at the end, of a string of long mishaps for Metro North over 2013. So we're going to dig a little bit deeper into it, and joining us right now is a guy who spent a lot of time digging deeper into the way Metro North and other rail systems operate. Jim Cameron, former journalist, commuter advocate, who served for 19 years on the Connecticut Metro North Rail Commuter Council, but that's a story in and of itself. He writes the newspaper column and blog Talking Transportation. Jim Cameron, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Colin.
To the best of your ability, and I know this is all being sorted out by the NTSB and other people, but to the best of your ability, tell us what you think happened yesterday on these tracks that run from Poughkeepsie down to Grand Central.
Well, we're still going to have to figure out the why, but clearly the physics of it talk about what happened, and that is that a train that was going 70 miles an hour approached a curve where it's supposed to be going 30 miles an hour, and was not able to slow down. So either because there was a problem with the track or there was human error involved or there might have been a problem with the brakes on the train, the physics of the train, you know, kept it moving forward. It did not make the 90-degree left-hand turn it's supposed to, and it continued off into the woods, and the front car ended up pretty close to the edge of the water there.
Now, I've ridden on this particular line recently, and the trains are much newer looking anyway than the ones that you ride from Grand Central to New Haven on the Metro North line. Do you know anything about the kinds of trains that run on this track? I somehow or other think you do.
Well, absolutely. They're actually not that much newer. The newest cars on all of Metro North are the M8 cars, the electric cars that run along the main line in Connecticut. These cars, when you look at the pictures, I want you to notice that the front two cars have red stripes down the side. The others are blue stripes. The red stripes mean they were bought by the state of Connecticut. They're supposed to be running in Connecticut. The blue stripes are for Westchester County. But they take all these Bombardier cars, unpowered cars, put them into a pool. So that train consists, those passenger cars and that locomotive could just as easily have been operating in Connecticut on the Danbury branch, on the Waterbury branch. My concern today is I've heard nothing out of the Connecticut Department of Transportation or Governor Malloy of concern, as I have, about if there's a systemic problem with these cars, if the brakes failed and it was not track problems or human error. These same train cars are running today right now in Connecticut. Are they safe?
So the train that's pushing these cars, I'm assuming, therefore, is a diesel train?
It's a diesel locomotive, and in this case, it operates diesel north of the electric territory on the Hudson Line, which starts at Croton Harmon, and then it uses third rail power, but it is diesel. And the fact that it was pushing as opposed to pulling is also something I think the NTSB is going to look at. Because, the physics of it is, whatever the cause of the derailment, whether it was speed, human error, or a track problem, when you've got all that momentum of a locomotive behind you pushing and the front train goes off the tracks, I think that helps attribute or explain the helter-skelter pattern you see of how the cars were spread out over the territory. Now, Metro-North runs all of its trains, its diesel trains, push-pull like that, and they always put the locomotive at the north end of the train, so they're always pushing into Grand Central. There are some who think that's not safe. The railroad says it's perfectly safe. If it wasn't safe, the National Transportation Safety Board would tell us not to do it. Well, let's see what they say when they look at that, because I think that may have contributed not to the accident, perhaps, but maybe to the injuries and the fatalities that happened inside, because those cars were very violently pushed in a lot of different directions by the momentum of the locomotive pushing behind it.
So, and as you say, NTSB is investigating. We don't know exactly everything that happened now, but it strikes me, Jim Cameron, I mean, we live in 2013. I'm amazed that some of this is even reducible, possibly, to human error. I mean, wouldn't it be possible? I don't know. I've ridden trains all over the world. I feel like they probably have governors or something on them that make sure that they don't go too fast when they're going into a curve.
Well, ironically, there was a similar accident a few years ago in Los Angeles that resulted in fatalities. In that case, the train derailed because the engineer was texting. He wasn't paying attention. But as a result of that, the Federal Railroad Administration, there is such an agency, has mandated that all passenger railroads in the country, commuter lines included, have to put in what's called positive train control. In other words, an automatic braking system. If the train is going too fast, it will put that train into a braking mode. Ironically, just about, I think, 2 weeks ago, Metro North finally announced that they have let the contracts to build and install that positive train control system along the Metro North tracks, as it has to be in by the year 2015. So we don't have something like that now. It is possible to either run through a red signal or for human error to run faster than is allowed. But again, even with positive train control, if it was a brake failure, if there was something mechanical, even if it was the brakes were activated automatically, if the brakes didn't work, the brakes wouldn't work even in a positive train control situation.
Gotcha. So we've got one set of problems, which is that a train, for some reason or other, went off the tracks. Now, once the train goes off the tracks, a bunch of other things start happening in those cars.
Yeah.
People are obviously being flung about the cars and in several cases flung from the cars. And you've got stuff that's in the car that I assume is now turns into a bunch of projectiles. So I don't know. Do people who look at train safety look at those questions too?
Absolutely. And when they were investigating the collision that happened in May at Bridgeport, one of the things they looked at was the structural integrity of the M8 cars, and they held up fairly well, but also the stuff that was inside the cars that started flying around as a result. So I've actually heard from a couple of commuters who are asking themselves questions about what can they do if they can't control derailment issues. What can they do to make themselves a little safer on the train? Well, one of the things you can do is maybe not sit at the front of the first car. Stay in your seat until your station has arrived, so you're not standing in the vestibules in case there is a derailment. That contributed to a number of injuries in the Bridgeport case. Passengers were standing up waiting to get off the train and were flung about. I'm also conscious when I take a seat on the train, you know, is there like a 200-pound trunk sitting on a luggage rack on top of me? And where is that going to go? You know, the airlines make safety announcements. Stay in your seat, seatbelt fashion. Leave your overhead luggage where it is. I think common sense may make commuters start thinking about those kind of issues as well, too.
You know, we have had quite a year here in Connecticut. You were talking about the Bridgeport accident. This is the May accident in which more than 70 people were injured when two Metro North trains collided after a derailment. We had a rail worker killed not long after that in a separate accident. We had the power failures. We've had a garbage train that derailed not at all far on that Metro North Hudson line from where yesterday's crash was. So, and I know this has sort of been, you know, part of your life's work. It's just sort of talking about whether or not we're maintaining these systems well and whether the interaction between government here in Connecticut, the DOT, and Metro North itself leads to a good, well-operating, high-functioning train system. So should we look at all those things and see a pattern, or are all these things kind of unrelated to each other?
Well, you just kind of talked about the pattern and the fact that we've had these four incidents in just a period of about 6 months or so is rather frightening. I'd also point out the fact that Metro North is celebrating its 30th anniversary, and that means that its most senior employees are now eligible for pensions. They have lost something like 10 or 20% of their most senior experienced executives in all aspects of train operation. That concerns me, as it did the NTSB. They asked about that as well, too. I would remind everybody that the state of Connecticut's Department of Transportation hires Metro North to run our trains. We have a contract with them. I hope that the DOT is looking at Metro North on a regular basis and evaluating how they're doing as that vendor of choice. There are other agencies that could run our trains for us. And I don't think Metro North has ever been given a second guess by the DOT. Again, I'm wondering where the DOT is today, where the governor is, why they haven't spoken out about these issues. Because this accident occurred at Spoyton Dival, it could have occurred on the Danbury branch.
Now, another thing that happened this year, Jim Cameron, is that the commuter council that you were involved with was kind of reformatted. Governor Malloy essentially tried to kind of add it, or did succeed in kind of adding it to his sphere of control in a way that it wasn't before. You weren't happy about that. I mean, is this, to your way of thinking, another part of the problem is that that a lot of the questions that you have and that other commuters have are kind of facing a more impermeable government than there ought to be?
I can say in the 19 years I've served on the council, there have been times where there was greater candor on the part of both Metro North and the Department of Transportation. I have found in recent months that candor has been lacking, that there has been what I've described as a conspiracy of silence and obfuscation. They don't want to talk about the problems. I don't think they've been honest and candid with the old commuter council or the new one in recent months, and that's why I stepped down. I'm organizing a new commuter action group to try and get real grassroots-level support from commuters to reach out to elected officials, state and federal, because I think that's the place we're going to finally be able to change this attitude at Metro North and the DOT. So I've resigned from the council, but I'm not quitting my advocacy.
No, I think that was probably a given. Jim Cameron from the blog and newspaper column Talking Transportation, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Colin. Thanks.
All right. We're going to move on here because that's what we do on The Scramble. One of the reasons we call it The Scramble. We're going to be talking about Pope Francis right after this. All right, we're back. This is The Scramble. I should say, by the way, as we're talking about Pope Francis, I should have said this while we were talking about trains, too. If you want to call in, 860-275-7266. If you want to tweet at us, it's at WNPRColin, where our tweet master, Greg Hill, is running things right now. And he will be tweeting to you also at WNPR Colin. But please do feel free to call in. We're going to talk now about Pope Francis's apostolic exhortation. Our number here, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Sometimes I feel, you know, I think we all have this feeling that a certain story should be covered even more than it's being covered. And ever since Pope Francis issued his apostolic exhortation more than a week ago now, I've been thinking, you know, I mean, there's been coverage of it, but to me, it's a bigger, bigger thing than maybe a lot of people are making it into. Michael Sean Winters is really a kind of our go-to guy about Catholic issues. He writes the award-winning blog Distinctly Catholic for the National Catholic Reporter, author of several books as well. Michael Sean Winters, first of all, maybe we need to begin by explaining what an apostolic exhortation is. It reads kind of like a really long halftime locker room speech, kind of, you know, a sort of let's go out and win this game, team.
Usually, well, this apostolic exhortation basically was intended to bring together the deliberations of a synod of bishops that was held last year on the new evangelization, which discussed how do you propose the gospel in a kind of postmodern society. That is actually not what Pope Francis wrote. What he wrote was almost an inaugural address, really setting out a very ambitious agenda for the church in his pontificate. And so it obviously deals with the theme of the new evangelization, but what he puts front and center is the church's work on behalf of social justice. And that was not so apparent last November during the Synod of Bishops.
So you've got a 106-item, 86-page document, but the things that people really have been talking about, I mean, I don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but my sense reading it is some of the messages, well, let's get a little bit out of the culture wars business and a little bit more into the gospel business and a lot more into talking about highly disadvantaged people. Now, really, the sort of economic justice part of this document is really items, I think, 54 through 60 out of the 106 items, but they've excited an awful lot of people's interest because he's talking in a way that you typically don't hear, well, much of anybody talk these days about what's fair and what's not fair and whether or not capitalism, as it's currently practiced, can ever lead to the kind of harmonious environment in which people's beliefs can flourish.
I think there are two indictments of contemporary capitalism in the text, and one, as you indicate, I mean, this is a pope from the first pope from the global south. And he was the head of the Argentine Bishops' Conference during the 2001 sovereign debt crisis in Argentina. And so he's acutely aware of how very powerful entrenched economic interests define the rules in such a way that they are rewarded no matter what happens. And if, as a consequence, programs that help the poor have to be cut, the powerful economic interests are content to live with that and that they hide behind what he calls this ideology and idolatry of money. And it's a very, very powerful indictment. Not hugely different from what we saw under Benedict and John Paul II, except it's much more blunt. They never referred, for instance, specifically to trickle-down economics.
Mm-hmm.
And he does and condemns it. He's very explicit that the state must set the rules of the road to ensure the common good. Which is something that has been debated in certainly in American Catholic circles a lot for the last 20 years. The second part of the indictment, though, has gotten less attention, and I think it's just as important. I think he raises the question of whether a system that at the same time and by its very nature creates material wealth also creates spiritual poverty. And this is, I think, the hardest part of the kind of, you know, laissez-faire defenders. They have a hard time washing that off because he's not really just condemning capitalism, but the consumer society that it has bred and this disposable culture and what he calls a globalization of indifference. And, you know, some of the conservative critics have said, oh, the Pope really doesn't understand economics. He should study economics before he talks about this stuff. The Pope doesn't make an economic argument. He makes religious arguments. So if they're going to fault him, they're going to have to fault him on the basis of a religious argument Not an economic one. And so far, that's not been forthcoming. And it's hard to imagine what it would look like.
Well, you know, and to that point, I mean, I don't know whether he timed it this way. I'm sure he doesn't think about the United States as much as he may think about other places. But, he, you know, he times it, it winds up being timed right before we head into a weekend of Thanksgiving, which is then followed by this, you know, I mean, talk about this, the disposable culture. Talk about the insane emphasis on consumerism, this period of shopping, which is then followed by, you pick up the New York Times today, and there's basically articles saying, well, people didn't shop enough. You know, people didn't buy enough things. This wasn't really what we really needed this weekend. It's not what the economy needed. That's a danger sign for the economy. And I find myself reading this and thinking, well, is it a danger sign for the economy? Or, I mean, it seems like, is there some other way of thinking about
this? Which is, are the rules of the way the economy is currently structured, are human beings expected to serve the needs of the economy, or is the economy expected to serve the needs of human beings?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the core of his indictment, and that this system, which, you know, some of the conservative critics say, actually, modern capitalism has lifted millions of people out of poverty. And even if that's true, it is still nonetheless a system built on winners and losers. And his point is that in the Christian view of the world, no human being is a loser. And in fact, the losers, whether they are undocumented or unemployed or unborn, these are the people the church must always specifically stand up for. And that's a very powerful message, and it's quite clear it's not going away anyway anytime soon. This is going to be the central motif of this pontificate.
And, you know, even though you say he speaks in religious terms or spiritual terms as opposed to economic terms, or at least as opposed to being an economist, I mean, he really did kind of take his game to them a little bit, too. I mean, when he's talking about trickle-down economics at the end, he says this opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. I mean, that's all made to back up a spiritual argument, but it's a pretty strong economic argument, too. He feels as though, anyway, he has a powerful economic argument to make.
And it's certainly one that you've not heard in American political discourse from the left or the right so clearly and profoundly stated.
Yeah.
I mean, you almost wouldn't know where to locate him on the political spectrum. I saw that Rush Limbaugh, you know, condemned him for spouting pure Marxism. And there's not a single Marxist sentiment in any of this. But there is this kind of binary worldview that the Tea Party has, that you are either in favor of laissez-faire economics, or you're a Marxist.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, that does a disservice to John Paul II. It does a disservice to Benedict. And clearly, it's a box that they're not going to be able to fit Pope Francis into, that he is not imbued with Marxist thoughts, but he nonetheless has this deep concern for the poor. And that it's simply not reflected. I thought one of the most powerful parts of the exhortation was where he said, you know, why is it a tragedy when the stock market loses 2 points, but there's no news when people are dying on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, is there an economic aspect to that? But yes, but clearly this is a voice of a pastor. Maybe that's what I was trying to say, not a voice of an economist. He's not identifying the economic successes or failures. He's talking about human successes or failures. And again, this is where the argument from economists fails, when they say, well, there's a variety of Catholic views on these issues. That's true, but they all have to, result in justice. And as soon as you're talking about justice, you are in the classic moral framework of the Catholic social teaching.
We're talking to Michael Sean Winters from National Catholic Reporter, writes the award-winning blog Distinctly Catholic. There's so much in this apostolic exhortation, and I'm sort of wondering, Michael Sean, do you have a sense of how it's playing around the world? We know that Rush Limbaugh and his ilk don't like it any more than Sarah Palin was happy with the Pope earlier in this season. But I look at this, and it's so potentially revolutionary, at least in the sense that it could really change the world if people paid a lot of attention to it. And I keep waiting for, I don't know, page one stories and magazine covers all over the place, and I don't see as many of them as I would expect. And is that confined to the U.S.? Is this more of a firecracker elsewhere in the world?
Well, I think, you know, papal documents take a long time to sink in.
Mm-hmm.
As you pointed out, it's, you know, over 80 pages long. The key is, how will this be taught at Catholic universities? How will it be taught at Catholic seminaries? So I think it will bleed into the church over a long term. A document like this is not intended for a headline tomorrow, although it got a remarkable number of them. Mm-hmm. I think what you see with his gestures when he went to Lampedusa to visit the migrants who were coming over and dying en route from Africa to Italy, when he went to the prison on Holy Thursday and washed the feet of the prisoners, these are the ways that he is communicating in a real clear way that does grab the headlines. And then this document can be seen as kind of giving the theoretical explanation of what those gestures mean, and putting some intellectual content onto those gestures. What's also remarkable about this pope is that you have a confluence of the gesture and the speech. Pope Benedict, bless his heart, had beautiful things to say about the poor, also denounced, you know, income inequality and things like this. But he would be doing it sitting on a throne wearing a 3-foot-tall, you know, hat covered with gems.
Mm-hmm.
There was a disconnect. And there's no disconnect here. So I think this pope, for a variety of reasons, has captured the imagination of the world in a way that has never happened in my lifetime. And we just have to hope that, whereas a typical papal document is read by no one, this will be read and consulted by people who never would have thought they would find themselves reading a papal document.
And, you know, this papal document is interesting also just for his rhetorical flair, too. I mean, as you've pointed out, it's unusual in an official church document with a Latin title to have the word sourpusses appear in the official English translation, right alongside phrases like self-absorbed, let's see if I can remember it, self-absorbed Promethean Neo-Pelagianism. I mean, he's both an intellectual and kind of an engaging writer.
Well, and very much a parish priest. You know, I mean, this is a guy who clearly, you know, as he likes to say, has the smell of the sheep. And a shepherd, he's not, you know, Benedict was a great intellectual and theologian who had a desk job for 35 years before he became pope. This man has been a bishop of a city that, as I mentioned, went through this horrible debt crisis, where you have horrible slums, and he is known in those slums. My colleague John Allen went down to Argentina right after the election, and his tour guide said, well, you know, I'm going to bring you to a slum, and you just pick out two people at random and see if they know the pope personally. And so the first person he went to was this woman. He just picked her at random, and she ran into her house and came out with two photos of her with then-Cardinal Bergoglio. So this is that very easy way of speaking and using a word like sourpusses. You know, that's obviously not coming from an intellectual tradition in the church. That's coming from having lived it.
Yeah.
And it's really refreshing.
Let me grab one quick call here. We've got John in New Hartford, and we're talking to Michael Sean Winters from the National Catholic Reporter. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you very much. Interesting show. My question has to do with health care. Cardinal Dolan was on the Talking Heads network shows over Sunday saying that the church will remain opposed to the health care law because of the contraception coverage. I was wondering if you thought this was consistent with Francis' new view, especially when he specifically mentioned just about the obsession with things like contraception, given that the health care law overwhelmingly helps the poor, whatever else you want to say
yeah.
about it.
So this may be a long-term question rather than a short-term one, Michael Sean, but it's the kind of question you tackle in your blog a lot, so go ahead.
Right. I want to confess I have not seen Cardinal Dolan's interview, but the church has always supported, including the U.S. bishops, have supported universal health insurance. Obviously, they oppose this mandate, which I would point out was not a part of the underlying law, right? I mean, the underlying law gave certain authorities to the Secretary of HHS, and she promulgated this contraception mandate under those rules. But it was not part of the underlying law. If the courts, which decided last week to take a challenge to the mandate, if they invalidate that, it doesn't mean Obamacare goes away. So that's the first point. It's also worth noting, though, that I think the bishops did oppose Obamacare at its time for different reasons. First of all, it did not cover undocumented workers. And secondly, they didn't feel that the provisions against abortion funding were tight enough. I think they were wrong in that, by the way. but they did oppose passage of Obamacare. I wonder if they would do that had Pope Francis been, you know, the Bishop of Rome rather than the Archbishop of Buenos Aires 4 or 5 years ago. Because I think this is something you saw at the bishop's meeting in Baltimore last November. There is a recalibration.
Hmm.
They've talked about nothing but religious liberty and this HHS mandate for 2 years. And this year, their statement after the meeting really placed it alongside other principal concerns that the bishops have. That's not happened before in the last 2.5 years. So I do think you're starting to see a change, but I can't speak to what Cardinal Dolan said yesterday.
All right.
I watch ABC in the morning.
All right. Michael Sean Winters, great to talk to you. And we're going to wrap up this segment and move on to the next. But thanks for joining us today.
Take care, Colin. Thank you.
All right. Michael Sean Winters, we'll switch gears again when we come back. Our first thing we'll talk about is Kurt Vile, the incredible composer of the first half of the 20th century.
I'ma run the Catholic Church, I'ma run the Catholic Church. No, for real, ask around, no need to keep up the search. Velvet red robes in a giant hat, a chair of gold that's really old, I even got that. They had an ancient palace, I got an ancient palace.
Which would the Pope say is bigger, Holy Day, Black Friday, or Cyber Monday? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in the intro. The part of Bill Curry was played by Sting. For photos, links, articles, and video of the Faith Middleton Show staff acting out Three Penny Opera with giant puppets, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, a long-form conversation with comedian Colin Quinn. And now, back to Colin.
All right. This is the final segment here. What we try to do on Mondays is bring you at least one big ideas kind of person and just ask him or her what he or she wants to talk about. Brian Francis Slattery joins us. He's a member of Dr. Catterwall's cadre of clairvoyant claptraps. That's a musical group, an editor of the New Haven Review and a novelist. So he's got a lot on his mind all at once. Brian Slattery, welcome to the show.
Hey, Colin. Thanks for having me back.
So the first thing on your, well, sort of the list that we wound up with as a result of kind of emailing back and forth, I was fascinated to know that you and your band have really been tackling the music of Kurt Vile. And, well, just talk a little bit about that to sort of set the stage.
Yeah, sure. So part of this came about because we know a couple of wonderful sopranos who go by the name of the Signet Sisters. And we had this idea that we all kind of loved Kurt Vile. And we'd never sort of gotten an opportunity to put it all together because, you know, we didn't have all the pieces in place. But then when we all came together, we realized we could sort of pull it off. And it ended up being, like, a lot more practicing than we expected because the music is really pretty difficult, you know, and it takes some time to incubate, you know, and figure out how to do it well. But it ended up being sort of a place, you know, where we realized that, you know, just like Kurt Vile himself had sort of drawn from all of the music around him. You know, he lived from 1900 to 1950, so he, you know, there's classical music and jazz and folk and, you know, all kinds of things inside his music. You know, we came from a lot of different backgrounds too, and Kurt Vile ended up being one of those places where all of our interests converged.
You know, I mean, everybody knows Mack the Knife. That's probably the most famous Kurt Vile song.
Absolutely.
And then there's this sort of repertoire of songs that are relatively familiar songs to people, September Song.
Right.
Let's hear Tom Waits tackling another song. I believe this is also from Three Penny Opera.
You gentlemen who think you have a mission to purge us of the seven deadly sins. Should first sort out the basic food position, then start your preaching. That's where it begins. Your lot who preach restraint and watch your waist as well should learn for once the way the world is run.
See, so there are all these, there's several very, very beautiful Kurt Vile songs. I'm a huge fan of Speak Low, which you're going to hear at the end of the show today.
Yeah, and absolutely.
And September Song. But then there's this kind of very spooky, scary Kurt Vile stuff that's, you know, that's it's not at all delicate. It's, I mean, nothing that Tom Waits sings isn't going to be a little bit spooky and scary. But he didn't need to work too hard to make that one sound spooky and scary. And I think that's the thing that some people find off-putting about Kurt Vile, that it's Well, I think you say he makes the music do whatever he thinks needs to be done at that moment.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of his sort of stated objectives is that he thought that every song had to sort of serve a useful purpose. You know, so if the song was about something ugly, he would write a pretty ugly song about it. Of course, he wrote some really beautiful songs about ugly things, too. But, you know, he was not afraid to really sort of pile on some pretty aggressive atonality and really, you know, weird tonalities when he thought that that was what the song needed. And, you know, the thing is, part of it is that, you know, we actually love that kind of stuff. And, you know, one of the things that makes it fun to perform is that, you know, a set of Kurt Weill stuff will lurch from, like, some of the most beautiful songs you've heard to some really aggressively difficult music to listen to. But, in, you know, for us performing it, what was fun about that is that it gives you an excuse to really lay into it. And you have to find ways to make your enthusiasm for the music connect to the audience in front of you.
So you know, you've got this composer, and he really has been tackled by all kinds of people. So Nina Simone becomes one of his, you know, foremost interpreters in the jazz world.
Yeah.
And, you know, rock performers. Well, that Tom Waits cut that you just heard, I think, is from a tribute CD that also has Todd Rundgren and, I don't know, David Bowie and people like that on
right.
it. And Sting, of course, has done Three Penny Opera. And there are – but one of the things you pointed out is that there's sort of a wave of musicians right now. Some of them, like Amanda Palmer, the Dresden Dolls, actually do Kurt Weill songs, do them on stage. I think she's got Kurt Weill on the front of her piano that faces the audience. She's kind of hacked the name of her piano, so it looks like it says Kurt Weill. So you've got performers engaged in this kind of rock homage to Kurt Weill. But you've got a lot of bands like yours, Brian Slattery, Dr. Catterwall's cadre of Clairvoyant Claptraps, who even in the instrumentation, even in the lineup of instruments that you're using, kind of invites the kind of approach that you're talking about. Explain, like, what your band's made up of.
Sure. So our band right now has I play either violin or banjo or trombone, and then a guy named Adam Matlock plays accordion. Chris Catello plays electric guitar. Mike Bellucci plays percussion, and we either have a tuba player named Keith Yarbrough or a bass player named Mike Pepper, and then the two sopranos, you know, who are Ann Rhodes and Zora Rawling. And you know, one of the things that makes that particular kind of instrumentation work is that it's really, really flexible. You know, you can play all kinds of things, and even when the instrumentation is sort of quote unquote wrong for the song, it'll still sort of work because it sort of has that, like, the ruckus that you would associate with, like, you know, the Salvation Army band or something like that. And that sort of sound has I think really seen a huge resurgence. Right? There's been a real uptick in sort of like brass bands and, you know, folk groups with, you know, instruments that seem kind of thrown together. And it's, you know, it's easy to kind of extrapolate that, you know, the times are hard, so people like that kind of music.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think that there's a little bit of truth to that too, that, you know, it's the kind of thing where you can make a big noise without a lot of equipment and without a lot of sort of industrial, you know, meaning like music industry support, you know, to make it happen.
Well, so, and so much of Weill's music and his collaboration with Brecht anyway is about hard times,
is
about the oppression of war and the oppression of the Depression. But, you know, to your point, and let's give an example of one of those bands that sounds kind of thrown together and Middle European and gypsy punk. This is Gogol Bordello.
Start wearing purple, wearing purple. Start wearing purple for me now. All your sanity and wits, they will all vanish, I promise. It's just a matter of time. So yeah, start wearing purple, wearing purple. Start wearing purple for me now. All your sanity and wits, they will all vanish, I promise. It's just a matter of time. I know you since you were a 20. I was 20.
Gogol Bordello. So Brian Slattery, this is the kind of music, I mean, Kurt Weill would really, I think, feel as though his work was substantially extended by something like this.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of weird to speak for a guy who's been dead for, you know, 70 years almost. But Yeah, I mean, it's easy to imagine that he would be happy with, you know, where his legacy has gone, because I think that he always kind of had an eye towards, you know, playing music that regular people would like. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think he was playing for a necessarily, you know, elitist audience. You know, I think that he'd be pleased to see that, like, his legacy, you know, goes on in a lot of shows that people just sort of go to have a good time.
You know, for me, I was always had a very ambivalent relationship with Vile, and when working, I attended a cabaret camp at the O'Neill Center quite a few years ago, and I would say to the other cabaret performers, you put a Vile song in your set, you're going to sort of send your set off in a pretty weird direction, at least for a while. I mean, the songs, they don't have to sound like that, but they're almost invariably, minor keys with kind of Slavic and Middle European sounds in them that are maybe not typical of the rest of cabaret music.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I when I stand back from it all, I realize these songs have really, they have, first of all, to use the cliche, they've stood the test of time. And I think one of the reasons they do that is they do all work for certain purposes, just as you said, you know, they're there when some performer needs them.
Yeah, and I think, like, when we were working up the material ourselves, I mean, we really started to appreciate how, you know, both how difficult the music was, sort of in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was still a lot to challenge you too. You know, it wasn't just like, oh, here's this song from the 30s. You know, we've all kind of heard this thing before. You know, as soon as you look at the chart, you realize, oh wow, there's a lot going on here, and we need to really, you know, knuckle down and take care of it. It's not, you know, Kurt Vile was really good at doing a melody that would be pretty catchy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it was fairly weird, it would still kind of be an earworm. But then underneath those melodies are some very, very complicated harmonies.
Well,
you know, the more you do service to them, the better the song is.
Let's end this part of our discussion with one of the earworm melodies. This is sort of interesting. I got into kind of hate watching a show called Smash. It was about Broadway. And so everybody on the show would burst into song at various times. But the one person who didn't burst into song at all was Angelica Houston. And one of the reasons for this is that Angelica Houston can't really sing. But near the end, it was either in the penultimate or final episode, they gave her a song. Or maybe she insisted on having a song. It's a song her grandfather famously sang. And so they suddenly have her on a stool and she sings the song and she really can't sing. But you, well, anyway, we'll just play a little bit of it.
Oh, it's a long, long while from May to December, but the days grow short when you reach September, when the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. One hasn't got time for the waiting game. Oh, the days dwindle down.
We'll fade it out before she gets out of her range. But, you know, that's, Brian, a moment where, I mean, a lot of things are being said, maybe about the end of the series, maybe about where Angelica Houston feels like she is in her life. And you realize that song was just there waiting for her to sing it sometime.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's true of a lot of the songs. They tend to sort of become relevant all over again in a really specific way, you know, not just kind of in a general, you know, we don't like war or everybody likes to fall in love. Like, they end up being a little bit more specific than that.
Yeah. All right, we have to switch topics here really quickly. You are an author, and there have been several declarations recently, one of them by the new book editor for BuzzFeed, but also by the critic Lee Siegel, wrote a similar kind of piece for The New Yorker a while ago about how he doesn't want to write negative book reviews anymore. He doesn't see the point of it.
Mm-hmm.
He realizes it's kind of a blood sport in England, but he doesn't want to do it anymore. The new book editor of the BuzzFeed basically saying the same thing, follow the rule in Thumper and Bambi. If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. Do you see anything wrong with that policy?
You know, it's actually one that I think I almost completely agree with it. You know, I think that, like, for the sort of big authors, you know, when they reach a certain stage in their career where they've written a book that everybody thinks, you know, is pretty much a stone-cold masterpiece, I mean, I you know, I hate to say it to people because it seems kind of mean, or like the price of success or something. But, you know, if somebody writes a book like that, it's fair to ask when they write another one if it's as good as this, you know, as this masterpiece that they wrote. But I actually agree with it for just about everything else. I mean, I think that there's a way that, you know, the negative book review is you know, I think ultimately I read book reviews at least because I want to buy books. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to just be told that something is bad. I'm looking for something new and interesting to read. You know, so like by that logic, it makes a lot of sense. You know, that there's so many books coming out now, and it's very difficult to keep track of all of them. And you know, it would be really nice if you could pick up a newspaper or a magazine and actually end up buying a book out of the deal instead of just learning that, you know, somebody's book isn't very good and you shouldn't pay much attention to it.
Although it does at least offer you the promise of saving the time and money that would have been spent on an inferior book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, which is why it seems fair to, you know, to take down a guy who you know is going to sell very well one way or the other.
We're talking to Brian Slattery right now. We probably have enough time also to discuss one last thing, which is, let's say that you did read one of those book reviews and you did decide that you wanted that book and you couldn't find your way to a nice bookstore on the streets of New Haven or elsewhere, and you decided you would order it from Amazon, which we don't necessarily recommend. Well, as of last night, Jeff Bezos is talking about delivering those books and other things that weigh 5 pounds or less to you. This won't happen right away. It's a little ways down the line, by octocopter drone. So you'd get it in 30 minutes. It would leave some kind of a fulfillment center. I love that name, too. A nearby distribution center. And you would be fulfilled when these things showed up. He says, I know this looks like science fiction. It's not. Since you do write science fiction, what's your reaction to this whole scenario?
I know what you're saying. I've always found that phrase to be sort of weird, right? I mean, there's something almost a little condescending about it to just about everybody, you know, who's involved in it. You know, as if people don't have the imagination, you know, to imagine as soon as drones exist that, yeah, sure, like, why wouldn't you use them to deliver packages and do all kinds of benign things apart from, like, the, you know, the horrible things that they're accused of being used of now.
But there's a way in which this conversation, I hate to tie a bow up around a show that we've just done, but, you know, we started out talking about Metro North, which is sort of technology going wrong when you don't maintain it. Then we went to the Pope, who's very critical of the whole culture of consumerism and instant gratification. Now we're talking about an Amazon system that will make you wait no longer than 30 minutes.
No, it's pretty crazy. I mean, as a science fiction writer, and I think a lot of people I know who write science fiction would do the same thing. Like, you immediately start troubleshooting that idea. You know, like, how do you sign for the package? You know, what happens when there's a mix-up, when it gets delivered to somebody else? You know, there's no one to argue with. You know, the drone just flies off, and you're left with, you know, like a kitchen table you didn't want, that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's also, I wish I could, I bet you can, but I think there's a Neal Stephenson novel where he talks about, it's set in a time where there are only like two things left that America's any good at, and one of them is high-speed pizza delivery. I can't remember what the other one is either. But,
yeah, I mean, I take some comfort in the fact that probably the drone, like Amazon's drone program will go wrong, just like a lot of drone programs seem to go wrong.
But it does seem there's something empty about the idea. Like, the most exciting thing that we're going to hear about from the perspective even of our culture and our economy this week may be how fast they can get something to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure, as opposed to sort of giving you a second to question whether you actually want the thing.
Exactly. All right. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us, Brian Francis Slattery. He is.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll talk to you again very soon. He's a writer of novels and a player of music. So let me just quickly tell you here, as we're heading into the rest of the week, that tomorrow we'll have a long-form conversation with Colin Quinn, the comedian who's doing a show about the U.S. Constitution. And then on Wednesday, we're going to do a show about blood pressure. I've been wanting to do this show for a long time. Blood pressure is a much more interesting and complicated thing than you probably think. Just take my word for it right now. I also want to say that if you like the way we do these Monday shows, the Scramble, we put them together on for relatively short notice. We don't plan them very far in advance. If you like them or you hate them or you're somewhere in between and you want to tell me, the email address is Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org.
Amazon drone, you already dropped off my inflatable swing set. Why are you still hovering? What, do you want it like a tip, or... Ugh, this sucks. Here's a Bitcoin.